Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Session number 70 on the printed program, which entails a paper to be given by Malcolm Thorpe, entitled James E. Talmage and the Victorian Lives of Jesus. Mr. Thorpe is a professor of history at Brigham Young University. He lives in Orem with his wife and five children. He has been there since 1969. He specializes in English history and has placed emphasis on the religious history in England. He graduated from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He has written numerous articles, including contributions to the Journal of Mormon History. He is presently working on a book concerning Herbert Butterfield, a noted British historian who has prominence in the 1940s and 50s. After his presentation, we will hear from Philip Barlow as a response. Mr. Barlow is a resident of Bountiful, Utah. He graduated from Weber State College in history and psychology and received his master's degree in Harvard University in religious studies. He is presently working on his doctorate degree at Harvard in American religious history and has prepared his dissertation on the Mormon use of the Bible. He also has recently edited a book entitled A Thoughtful Faith, Essays on Belief by Mormon Scholars. Following the response, if there is time, we are told that there will be an opportunity to have a question and answer period, and we would encourage you to participate in that. Turn the time over then to Malcolm Thorpe.
James E. Talmage has been rightly viewed as one of the three European immigrants who reshaped LDS theology in the early 20th century, the other two, of course, being Widtsoe and Roberts. Talmage's specific contribution was described as consisting of a fundamental reinterpretation of the nature of the Godhead as well as the doctrine of man. It is also apparent that Talmage played the major role in embedding Mormon thought on the earthly mission of Jesus in the safe orthodoxy of the Victorian Lives of Jesus tradition, the purpose of which was to make Christian beliefs safe, critical approach of modern biblical criticism. This paper attempts to demonstrate Talmage's reliance on Victorian biblical scholarship and, more specifically, to assess his place within this tradition. It will be argued here that Talmage's masterpiece, Jesus the Christ, owed much to the Victorian Lives of Jesus writers, especially Frederick W. Farr, both in terms of approaches to subject matter as well as materials presented. While there are certain differences between Talmage and these writers, the similarities are altogether too obvious to be ignored. Talmage began his work on Jesus in a series of lectures at the Latter-day Saint University Sunday School during the school terms of 1904 to 1906. A trained geologist by an educator by profession, Talmage lacked formal skills as a biblical scholar, especially knowledge of ancient languages. Nevertheless, from the beginning of his teaching career, Talmage displayed an interest in gospel themes, and his training in science encouraged him to collect together references for his frequent lectures on LDS topics. While his elaborate journals make no mention of an interest in biblical textual criticism, which had only made an impact on American scholarship within his lifetime, it is obvious that he was aware of these new currents of thought and reacted negatively to them. In his earlier book, Articles of Faith, Talmage asserted that evidence of the Bible, both internal and historical, proved the genuineness of the various separate parts, that the Bible has come down to use through the work of a special providence, and, although there were some errors in the text, these he believed were minimal. In addition, Talmage stated that all human efforts to bring forth a better edition of the Bible were nothing more than the works of man, and the only way in which an improved text could take place was through prophetic inspiration. In short, Talmage's treatment of the Eighth Article of Faith provided little encouragement for the study that came to be known of as higher criticism. Nor did Talmage wish to promote such an approach in his study, Jesus the Christ. In the preface to that work, Talmage described his purpose as formulating a narrative of Jesus' earthly mission that was based on the explication of, quote, Holy Writ of olden times in the light of present-day revelation. It is true that there is much in his text that is derivative from the LDS tradition, materials that need not concern us here. It simply doesn't relate to what I want to develop. But it is also obvious that the central core of Talmage's approach relies heavily on Victorian writers. For example, the underlying thesis of Jesus the Christ is that the text of the Gospels is reliable, that discrepancies in the story are minimal and insignificant, and that none of the textual problems are important enough to cast the least shadow of rational doubt upon the historicity of the story of Jesus of Nazareth. Thus, the modern believer should not fear textual exegetes who quibble over details and purposefully mislead through falsely portraying the supposed logical inconsistency in the story. What is interesting is that this same message can be found, as we shall see, in Farr and his counterparts in late 19th century Britain. Any discussion of the tradition of Victorian lives of Jesus must begin with an examination of Daniel Powell's book on this subject, which was published in 1982. In this book, Powell's attempted to demonstrate the similarity of approach that one finds in reading the genre of Victorian biographies of Jesus. While these voluminous biographies are of considerable interest to our understanding of the cross-currents of Victorian thought, none of these studies are of importance to biblical scholarship today. For, as Powell shows, all of the lives were lacking in critical content and were derivative from a standard collection of conservative writers who represent a reaction against the current German trends of biblical criticism. In the late 19th century, however, the biographers of Jesus played a pivotal role in the process by which Christianity in Britain reconciled itself with the growing awareness of biblical criticism, especially after the publication in English of Julius Wellhausen's monumental study of the history of Israel in 1885. According to Powell, these writers softened the impact of the new criticism, thus enabling Britain to avoid the bitter falling out that occurred in America between the fundamentalists and the liberals. Powell observed that anyone who read of Wellhausen and his doubts about the Old Testament had an equal opportunity to open a life of Christ and read its reassurance about the new. The Victorian lives were perceived as the products of criticism, but with a difference: positive, reassuring, above all, faith-promoting. For our purposes, Powell's discussion of the Victorian Big Three writers is of importance, especially because Talmage used these three extensively in his work. Frederick W. Farr's scholarship, according to his son-in-law, belonged rather to the extensive than the intensive school. His book, The Life of Christ, 1874, resembled a summa of safe orthodox opinion, including the work of Cambridge scholars such as Westcott, Hort, and Lightfoot. German textual criticism was not only virtually ignored, but there is an underlying theme of rejection of such probings. But what Farr could not explain with the text, he relied on exotic materials that he gleaned from his travels in the Holy Land, as well as fanciful descriptions that brought about charges of sensationalism. In spite of limitations, Farr's life was a publication landmark for a book of this kind, going through as many as 12 reprintings in 1 year. Not far behind Farr in reader appeal was J. Cunningham Geckie in his book Life of Christ, 1877, which, according to Powell, was written as a conscientious imitation Farr. In many ways, a stylistically more satisfying biography, Geckie too tended to be better at synthesis than original analysis. Indeed, the most original of the three was Alfred Edersheim, a convert to Christianity and a recognized authority on Jewish customs at the meridian of time. In 1883, his The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah appeared, providing Victorian readers with an abundance of historical detail on social conditions during the time of Jesus. But however interesting Edersheim is, even for modern readers, his book followed the same pattern of interpretation as Farr and Gecky. As Powell stated, the curious thing about this vast storehouse of information was that it apparently coexisted in the same mind with a critical innocence difficult to fathom. What Powell fails to point out, however, is that the slowness in accepting new foreign methodologies, especially German textual criticism, and the conservatism in eventual adopting such new thought fits well into the English tradition of gradualism. Given Powell's purpose of relating the Victorian biographers of Jesus to cultural cross-currents, he perhaps would have been less shocked about such resistance if he had been more reflective on the broader pattern of cultural assimilation that traditionally occurred in the British Isles, with this rather slow and conservative adoption of foreign ideas. Powell says about the writers of Victorian biographers that, quote, they reveal too much about the intersecting currents of Victorian society, popular attitudes, religious thought, biblical study, and cultural change to be passed over so easily. Unfortunately, however, much more could have been said about this theme than Powell's reveals. Much more, for example, could be said about Canon Farr's treatment of Jesus than Powell reveals. Indeed, Farr was so caught up in the religious controversies of his day that the book loses relevance for contemporary audience. Farr was so fiercely anti-Catholic and anti-atheist that his narrative was encumbered by such sectarian notions. Also typical of the Victorian frame of mind, Farr's biography contained an underlying theme of the idea of progress, as well as the corollary notion of the superiority of Western cultural traditions. Consider the following exposition, which reveals more about what smug and confident Victorians thought about their world than the realities of conditions. Come and see a dying world revivified, a decrepit world regenerated, an aged world rejuvenated. Come and see the darkness illuminated, the despair dispelled. Come and see tenderness brought into the cell of imprisoned felon and liberty to the fettered slave. Come and see the poor and the ignorant and the many emancipated forever from the intolerable thraldoms of the rich, the learned, and the few. Come and see the hospitals and orphanages rising in their permanent mercy besides the crumbly ruins of colossal amphitheaters which once reek of human blood. Come and see the dens of lust and tyranny transformed into sweet and happy homes, defiant atheists into believing Christians, rebels into children, and pagans into saints. It's a rather interesting description of social change in the 19th century. I might say that the same kinds of conditions, the Mormons were talking about Babylon and the imminent fall of Babylon. These significant advances in Western civilization were seen as the result of adherence to Christian truths, whereas other great historical religions, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, were viewed as decadent and socially debilitating. And Farr's treatment of the Jews was hardly in keeping with his avowed concern for charity. For in short, there are passages in his narrative which reveal anti-Semitic beliefs, as well as traditional notions of Jews as being punished as the result of the ancient crime of crucifixion of their Lord. Given the above prejudices, it is not surprising that there are racial overtones in Farr's biography. Thus, Jesus is depicted as a Teutonic ideal rather than as a Jewish man. And this is what he says. He is a man of middle size and about 30 years of age, on whose face the purity and charm of youth are mingled with the thoughtfulness and dignity of manhood. His hair, which legend has compared to the color of wine, is part in the middle. It's part in the middle of the forehead and flows down over the neck. His features are paler and of a more Hellenic type than the weathered bronze and olive tan faces of the hardy fishermen who are his apostles. Although Farr is still read today by conservative Christians and Mormons who wish to escape from the uncertainty of 20th century interpretations, it can be rightfully argued that Farr's study lacks those characteristics of transcendency that enables readers of various intellectual persuasions to regard it as a classical account. From the LDS perspective, there is additional reason for paying attention to Powell's book. Powell's persuasively demonstrates that Victorian lives writers tended to borrow profusely from one another, but especially from Farr. Thus, to read them, Victorian biographies of Jesus, as at times to feel as if one is passing through a museum gallery of reproductions. There is the same Jesus, the same Orthodox deity, drawn again and again by different hands. As we will now see, Talmage was greatly inspired by this tradition, and it is beyond question that, accepting the Mormon orientation of his book, Jesus the Christ can be properly seen as fitting into this tradition. While it would be too much to argue that Talmage produced yet another reproduction of the Victorian life of Jesus, it can be said that the narrative of Jesus the Christ follows closely the sequence established by Farr and his followers. As with other Victorian lives, it is not surprising that Talmage likewise wrote that there were two cleansings of the temple, two miraculous meals of bread and fish, as well as confidently assert that there was no essential contradictions in the narrative concerning the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. Besides Farr, Gecki, and Edersheim, most of the secondary sources used in Jesus the Christ predate the emergence of biblical criticism as a discipline. These include such Orthodox writers as Richard Chevenot Trench, whose study of miracles, 1846, was considered a classical answer to skeptics, as well as his study of parables. Also prominent were William Arnott's The Parables of Our Lord, 1865, and Samuel J. Andrews' The Life of Our Lord, 1863. What is also significant is that most of these sources were published before 1890, and a number of such references went back to the early 19th century, such as Adam Clark's Bible with a Commentary, 1810. Virtually all of the authorities were extensively used by Talmage were devotional writers who did not approach the Bible text from a historical perspective, and many of these books were certainly archaic works by the time that Talmage was writing. And like the dog that failed to bark in Sherlock Holmes' story, what is not found in Talmage's book is also revealing. None of the sources used employed the new critical methodology, a discipline that was producing a number of important studies in Britain by this time, that is to say, the time that Talmage was writing. We can also assert that Talmage borrowed such concepts as at-one-ment, that I'm sure all of you have heard, denoting reconciliation, from such writers, as well as his discussion of the meaning of the term Son of Man. This is clearly borrowed from Farr. Other elements in the story also come across as owing to the Victorian tradition. Talmage, for example, confidently argued that all of the problems of Jesus' genealogy, as revealed in the New Testament accounts, were answered as a result by studies by Mill and Harvey. In discussing the cryptical accounts of Jesus' childhood, Talmage and Farr looked upon the paucity of details as proof of authenticity, for inventive writers would certainly have added details. In both Farr and Talmage, John the Baptist's probable state of mind, a condition that in no way can be determined by the gospel account, as he languished away in prison, are discussed in such a striking way as to suggest Talmage's reliance on the earlier account. I might say that this was a special point with Farr. He sort of concentrated in many of his passages on states of mind. That's something that's rather typical of him. In addition, Talmage's discussion of Jesus as the world's greatest champion of the rights of women is echoed from the Victorian tradition. We should not accuse Talmage of dishonesty, i.e. plagiarism, here, for, as we have noted, all the Victorian lives of Jesus writers tended to borrow material from one another. Plagiarism is a word that has taken on a different meaning in contemporary scholarship, But in Talmage's time, it was perfectly acceptable to borrow from other writers, even without footnotes. Thus, rumors that circulate concerning Talmage's prolific borrowings without proper attribution are both exaggerated as well as unfounded in terms of the rules of usage during his time. In criticism of Pals, however, it can be said that there was a greater amount of individuality in the approaches of Victorian lives of Jesus writers than he admitted, and that this is most certainly true of Talmage. Talmage's Jesus the Christ is no carbon copy imitation of his predecessors. For instance, his exposition of the Gospels was a more closely literal treatment than any of the major Victorian writers, and Talmage's dialogue contained fewer historical materials that would give flavor to the life and times of Jesus. He also avoided the grandiloquent flamboyance of Victorian prose in favor of a more subdued, restrained style. Talmage's independence can also be seen in his occasional divergence from the chronological arrangement that it was generally followed by the Victorian biographers. In addition, he additionally refuted allegations from previous writers that he thought to be untenable. Still, even when the individual elements are taken into account, it must be admitted that Talmage's study was largely, but not exclusively, based on the Victorian tradition, and that, in addition to his extensive use of the King James Bible, he borrowed material from this tradition extensively. What is even more important, however, is that Talmage's methodological approach in interpreting the four Gospels was virtually the same as his Victorian predecessors. In other words, without question, there was a commonality of purpose and method which was shared with the Victorian lives of Jesus writers. Consider, for instance, Farr's attempt to establish irrefutable gospel harmony. The evidence of the evangelists, says Farr, as given by witnesses of unimpeachable honesty, we have every right to believe that, to whatever cause the confessed fragmentariness of their narratives may be due, those narratives may fairly be regarded as supplementing one another. It is dishonest to assume the existence of irreconcilable discrepancies, and it is to suggest the adoption of impossible harmonies. Likewise, Talmage wrote in the preface to his work, "True, there are diversities of deduction based on alleged discrepancies in the records and of the past as to circumstantial detail, but such differences are of strictly minor importance, for none of them, nor all taken together, can cast a shadow of rational doubt upon the historicity of the earthly existence of the man known in literature as Jesus of Nazareth. In other words, both authors found the text to be reliable and were critical of scholars who suggested there were textual problems in the narrative. Or, if such problems did exist, they were strictly minor in importance and did not distract from any way from the credibility of the accounts. Still, there were differences of degree between Farr and Talmage. While both writers were willing to admit that the Gospels were fragmentary in character and were often vague in details, Farr went even further by admitting that there were probably narrative traditions that superseded the writing of the Gospels, and thus the historical detail was oftentimes confused. He argued that there was at least one, possibly two, such common oral traditions that formed the basis for the Synoptic Gospels. He also admitted that, especially in accounts of Matthew and Mark, that the chronological arrangement was often determined by subjective considerations, i.e. material was grouped together for expository purposes to illustrate religious lessons rather than by a historical sequence. In addition, he admitted that each of the Gospels reflected their author's personal individualism, even their own natural suppositions. Nor was Farr convinced that all of the material included in the four Gospels was genuine. While he certainly believed in the accounts of the miracles, at least one such story was bothersome to him. Concerning the miracle of the fish caught by Peter to pay the temple tax, Farr believed that the story presented readers with a fine ethical lesson, but the historicity of this story obviously caused him problems. While he adhered that the intention of the narrative was to suggest that a miracle had been performed, Farr reasoned that the most literal translation of this passage would read that, quote, on opening its mouth, thou shalt get or obtain a stater, or the coin. And Farr continued, although there is no difficulty in believing that a fish could swallow a glittering coin that was accidentally dropped in the water, and hence the miracle could have taken place, but it was obvious that this incident caused Farr problems. For, he wrote, that the particularities, both of the miracle itself and of the manner in which it is narrated, leave in my mind a doubt as to whether, in this instance, some essential particular may not have been either omitted or left unexplained. Talmage, as usual, was in no way bothered by the circumstances of this miracle, and he offered a most literal interpretation of the happening. He argued that, although the finding of the stater in the mouth of a fish is not indicated in the text, we can assume that the miracle was realized, quote, as otherwise there would be no reason for introducing the incident to the gospel narrative. While admitting that the miracle was without parallel in the Bible, this, he said, need not raise any questions. In the passage aimed at chastising skeptics such as Farr, I think he was obviously reacting to Farr, Talmage asserted that the knowledge that there was in the lake a fish having a coin in its gullet, that the coin was a denomination specified, and that the particular fish would rise and be first to rise to Peter's hook, is as incomprehensible to man's finite understanding as the means by which any of Christ's miracles were wrought. The Lord Jesus held and holds dominion over earth and sea and all in them is, for his word and power were they made. Talmage then discussed the reasons for such a miracle, that is, by employing such a device for payment, Jesus maintained his independence as a king's son. As with other miracles discussed by Talmage, there is always a logical reason and an assumption that miracles were performed according to proper scientific principles, even though we do not know the scientific methods employed. That's another argument that comes from Victorian Lies, too, I might add. Talmage was primarily responsible for anchoring modern Mormon thought in biblical literalism. Indeed, he maintained that the LDS Church's interpretation of the Bible was more literal than any other denomination. While the official creedal position was that the Bible was true insofar as it was translated correctly, Jesus the Christ leaves the distinct impression that there were few textual problems, at least in the four Gospels. In only one major context does he suggest that there was a scribal error involved, that being John's statement that Christ was crucified about the sixth hour, while Mark has the event taking place at the third hour of the morning. Talmage believed that this was due to the error of earlier copyists who mistook the sign meaning third for that signifying sixth. While other errors and textual inconsistencies are alluded to, he believed that they were easily reconcilable. Essentially literalistic interpretation of LDS Bible study, what is interesting is that Talmage asks few questions about the intention of the writers of the four Gospels. There was no discussion of the differing purposes, say, between Matthew and John. Indeed, his treatment of John is most revealing of Talmage's approach. Considered by scholars to be the least historical of the Gospels, the Johnine account emphasized the transcendental and incomprehensible elements of the story of Christ. It is also generally assumed that the text of John was at least partially rearranged by a later redactor. The text that we have, it would seem, was intentionally arranged to formulate a narrative that was not concerned with biographical details or chronological sequence. Harmonized John's account with the others, arguing that the essential difference is really that John treated Jesus' Judean mission more fully, while the synoptic writers were more interested in the events that occurred in Galilee. When confronted with a problem such as John's early account of the cleansing of the temple, it was de facto assumed that there were two cleansings, even though the Johnine account of the incident reveals certain contextual problems as the story fits into the narrative. Also significant in terms of the logic employed is the account of the woman taken in adultery. Some scholars have raised questions with this incident because the story does not appear in early manuscripts of John, as well as the contention that neither the language nor the grammar of this passage are consistent with the with that contained in the gospel. While it might be well argued that the incident is authentic, certainly the approach of, to reasoning that Talmage used, which is adopted from Farr, does not clearly resolve the issue. Farr contended that the episode was historical, for, he said, why is it contained in so many important manuscripts that we do have? Most of these are rather late, I might say. Now, what is important here is the logic employed. There is clearly no building of a case based upon reasoned exposition of the various earlier versions. Rather, there is an authoritarian pronouncement that is aimed to convince the reader that no discussion is necessary. Talmage's Jesus the Christ is a book that is important to important to the restatement of theology that was taking place in the first decades of the 19th century. As a clear, concise statement of LDS beliefs, it is deservedly recognized as a Mormon classic. But this is not to say that the methodology used in 1915 and before is sacrosanct and the answers and answers the questions for today. It is sometimes argued in defense of the Victorian approach that these writers knew Jesus with greater insight and understanding than later scholars. But can such a statement, especially in the light of Powell's study, really be shown to be valid? Has the Victorian tradition really answered all of the important issues concerning the four Gospels, as well as the interpretation of Christ that is found in Paul and in the accounts of the early church? F.C. Burkett was arguably the greatest New Testament scholar in Britain during the early 20th century. Writing only a few years before Talmage, he asserted that the tangled questions of gospel history admit no easy solutions, orthodox or otherwise. Furthermore, he raised the question, why do we need historical criticism of the Bible? He replied to this question as follows: it is not to get new ideas of religion or of philosophy that we need a minute and searching historical criticism. Rather, do we need to test the ideas we already have by the historical facts. And we cannot get to at these facts without criticism. Not that it is always or generally an easy task or exercise to exercise a true historical criticism upon a great subject, and it is not only too easy to fall into error. But of this, at least, we must be confident that our errors will not long escape detection. It is not by our own generation, then by the next. And the attempt to return to the historic Christ is the only way by which we can escape from the tyranny of last generation's theories about Christ. What has oftentimes happened in the LDS discussions of the New Testament is that textual issues have been ignored, and authorities have been conjured up from the remote past in such a way as to suggest that textual problems themselves are a myth. And although Talmage was certainly forthright about where he got his ideas, we still like to imagine that we really get our ideas exclusively from the Bible and other revealed sources, rather than from secondary scholarly tradition that need to be defended through rational discourse. Any attempt at the interpretation of texts, either sacred or profound, obviously involves us with the preconceptions of the author and his age. It is always human minds that provide organization and interpretation of fact, which never entirely speak for themselves. I might say, too, that human minds create theology. Theology doesn't come out of the text itself either. Nor can we ever know the exact intention of a document, but especially ancient texts, where the gaps in language and cultural traditions between such past ages and the present are so wide. Thus, scholarship is always an ongoing process, and there is no room for embedding thought in the Procrustean beds of past generations. As new questions and new sources, such as Dead Sea Scrolls and biblical fragments of earlier manuscripts, come to light, which help us to understand the Gospels more fully, then seekers of light and truth should honestly approach their study through the mediums of both faith and reason. Thank you very much.
There are a number of legends that exist about James Talmage and the writing, I guess I'll just stoop down here, and the writing of the book Jesus the Christ, and I suspect that over the years most people in this audience have been subject to one or another of them. I was under the impression for some time in my earlier life that Brother Talmage never left the temple during the course of the writing of the book. I've had whispered, exaggerated reverence pointed out by a temple guide or two going through the temple about the room in the Salt Lake Temple in which he wrote, because he wrote the book in the remarkably short time of 6 months. It's been implied that he had to receive it all from heaven. It's an 800-page complicated and weighty book, and that was a quick period to write it in. The persons who would pass along those rumors not being aware, I think, that Brother Talmage had been working on the subject matter for a decade as he gave different lectures about Jesus the Christ. But legends aside, the book has been enormously influential, and I assume that I don't need to document that too much to this group. It was reviewed and critiqued by all the available general authorities before it was published, including the Quorum of the Twelve and the First Presidency. It's been standard reading for countless missionaries, and despite its great length and rather heavy prose and heavy subject matter, hundreds of thousands of copies have been sold, and I think that it won't be replaced soon as a treatment of Jesus the Christ among the LDS population anytime in the near future, because Brother McConkie wrote 400,000 pages about Jesus the Christ in his Messiah series. I think that includes Brother McConkie's work as well. So the book is important, and it's more important than we're always conscious of, I think, because it really does help shape how our community thinks about Jesus. And given that pervasive influence, it seems appropriate to think carefully about how the book was put together, about the qualifications of the author, about the sources which he depended on. And this Malcolm Thorpe has accomplished. I think he has accomplished it rather well and fairly. I was struck as he was reading this paper that I, with the fact that I had the advantage of reading it in advance, and I thought when you don't have a stand-up comic delivering the paper like we did in our last session, that it's sometimes a little harder to focus and follow orally than it is a written paper. So I acknowledge my advantage over you and hope that you caught the drift of the argument. Brother Thorpe has suggested to us correctly, I think, that the book was important and that Brother Talmage has been highly influenced and even largely dependent on other Victorian writers whose scholarship refused to accept the new badly called higher criticism of the Bible that originated in Germany and spread elsewhere, fast or slow, depending on the country under consideration. If Brother Thorpe intends to publish his paper, I might offer a quibble here and there on minor points. For example, to assert that Elder Talmage anchored modern Mormon thought in biblical literalism may be to take Tom Alexander's celebrated article on the reconstruction of Mormon theology a bit too seriously. Joseph Smith himself, as well as Brigham Young and many other Mormon leaders, often made political mileage, theological, religious mileage against their rivals by insisting that Mormons were the only ones to take the Bible literally and that others spiritualized the text and only accepted interpretations of the Bible, but Mormons took it just as it was, and that went on throughout the 19th century. And I would think, even though I think Brother Thorpe's point is that in the context of the war among religious liberals or religious conservatives about whether to accept the new modern scholarship, Brother Talmage's book tilted us in a certain direction. That's a point well taken, but I think it might be possible to at least entertain the idea that if James Talmage had never lived, Mormonism would still be anchored quite thoroughly in a biblical literalism. The woman taken in adultery that for a long time was suspect textually in New Testament studies, as a matter of fact, has been restored in more recent additions to the Revised Standard Version of the Bible with new textual weight. So there are a number of quibbles I might offer, but since I basically agree with the tenor of Brother Thorpe's treatment of Elder Talmage, I think that that would largely waste our time on minor points here today. So I would like to take just a couple of minutes and draw out two implications of the paper that you've just heard that struck me. Dr. Thorpe has shown how Elder Talmage, like Jesus' Victorian biographers on whom he was partly dependent, tended to see Jesus through Victorian eyes. This is dramatically suggested by Talmage's description of Jesus as the world's greatest champion of the rights of women. That may be true religiously, since we take Jesus as Lord and worship him, and we assume that he is concerned about fairness to women. But as a matter of fact, Brother Talmage bases that assertion on a biblical passage where Jesus says from the beginning it was not so that that the males could dismiss their wives so easily as they were apparently doing then. And so that's portraying Jesus as the world's all-time champion of the rights of women on that passage is curious, I think. The conception of Jesus as women's champion was borrowed from other biographers and reflected a common Victorian concern. The Victorian cultural lens is even more graphically suggested by Farr's description of the physical Jesus. And since I didn't see so much as any of you even crack a smile during that part of the reading, I thought I would try again and invite you to pay very careful attention. Farr suggests that, quote, he, that is Jesus, is a man of middle size. I wonder where we got that information. And of about 30 years of age, on whose face the purity and charm of youth are mingled with the thoughtfulness and dignity of manhood. He apparently has Jesus all physically pictured in his mind as he writes his biography. His hair, which legend has compared to the color of wine, is parted in the middle of the forehead, another intriguing detail out of the blue, and flows down over the neck. His features are paler and of a more Hellenic type than the weather-bronzed and olive-tanned faces of the hardy fishermen who are his apostles. That is, he was wider. Those dark eyes, Jesus was too pure to do that. That's kind of important stuff if we have our major conceptions of Jesus being formed, ours, that is, the Mormon communities being formed by a book, by a beloved apostle who was dependent on scholarship like that, because scholarship like that is nothing more than pure romance in scholarly-sounding prose. We don't know anything about the physical appearance of Jesus, and the first pictorial representations of him appear several centuries after Jesus' death. So, despite Dr. Thorpe's admirable scholarly restraint, I might describe such writing as sheer nonsense. It may be useful to remind those who are thoughtful enough to take Dr. Thorpe's presentation seriously, which I invite you to do, that every culture and every era has tended to see Jesus in their own... while they do that, while they create Jesus in their own image, they all the while assume that they are basing their vision on the gospel reports, because they do read the gospel. That, I think, may be obvious to you, but I would like to give you a half dozen interesting examples to implant that in your brains a little bit. I'm working on an essay that sometime within the next 8 or 10 months will see the light of day, called Jesus as Rorschach. You remember what Rorschach is, an inkblot test? That used to be popular among psychiatrists and psychologists, wherein a standardized series of ink blots are plopped on a piece of paper and you reflect on them and thereby create a window to your soul and mind for the therapist. It seems to me that Jesus really does function as a theological ink blot, a Rorschach test for various cultures. For example, and also it's important to note that this is true, in my opinion, at the popular level as well as at the scholarly level. Even though the scholarly level, of course, is more sophisticated, that still happens. In the 5th and 6th centuries of the Christian era, as monasticism was being launched in Western Christendom, passages like Mark 8 and 34, whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, were magnified in some circles so that the predominant image of Jesus in major circles of Christianity in the 5th or 6th century was Jesus as the perfect monk, or Jesus as the monk who rules the world. In later centuries, through the prevalence of Christian mysticism, Christ became, his predominant image became, in some circles, the bridegroom of the soul. And that, I won't go into, but sometimes had strikingly literal and erotic consequences in the literature. During the Renaissance of the 15th and 16th centuries, Jesus was transformed into the Renaissance man, a man for all seasons, the universal man. So we had Jesus being Thomas More. In the Enlightenment of the 18th century, Jesus was suddenly made a rationalist, the great teacher of common sense. Men so thoughtful and eminent as Thomas Jefferson published their own versions of the New Testament, from which they blotted out all of this nonsense about miracles and resurrection and virgin birth, and reduced Jesus, Jefferson and others regarded those miraculous accounts as superstitious accretions to the authentic documents, and we were left with a Jesus who could warm the hearts of all good deists. In the hands of the liberal biblical critics of the 19th century, as Albert Schweitzer has so forcefully shown us, Jesus became a religious liberal, not so very different in temperament from the liberal new theologians of the late 19th century. One of the most striking examples at the popular level I found of people finding justification for their own values in their image of Jesus comes from America in the 1920s. Businessmen before the 1929 crash were at their peak of influence and were among the most respected of all professionals. In this public esteem in the golden years before the world's before the great economic crash, one prominent group, the Interchurch World Movement, combined big business acumen with a post-World War I fervor to unite American Protestant into a single campaign for, quote, dollars, men, and spiritual revival. On the eve of the big campaign in April 1920, they issued a bulletin. They said their campaign was for Christ, quote, the biggest business of the biggest man in the world. In the effort to raise $300 million, a goal that was upped to $500 million and eventually to $1 billion in 1920, one of their slogans ran as follows. Christ was big, was he not? None ever bigger. Christ was busy, was he not? None ever busier. He was always about his Father's business. Christ needs big men for big business. The most popular work on the person of Jesus in the 1920s was The Man Nobody Knows by Bruce Barton, who gave the man from Nazareth front rank among the world's business organizers. Unbelievable as it now sounds, the book's epigraph was the query of the boy Jesus when he was found in the temple. Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business? Italicized. Now, if Christ's dominant image in any given age can range from the perfect monk to the biggest businessman in the world, we would be wise to judge James Talmage's Victorian conceptions of Jesus as the all-time champion of the rights of women with a great deal of tolerance. However, this leads us to a final consideration, one that I take to be the major implication of Dr. Thorpe's essay. What about our own perception of Jesus? Who do we think he is? Our perceptions are doubtless colored by cultural assumptions of which we are not even aware. More specifically, what about the available tools of modern biblical criticism? Is it too much to expect a church that is based on belief in a divine Christ to be enthused about methods perceived as threatening that very basis? Is that a realistic hope that any of us have, that a church that is based on belief in a divine Christ could possibly be enthused about methods perceived as threatening to the very basis of their belief? Perhaps it is too much to ask. For the instinct to survive runs deeply in organizations as well as human beings. But this, for me, in fact, begs the question, for it is, after all, possible to fully master and fully appreciate the issues and tools of modern criticism and still believe that Jesus is Christ. As the agnostic Will Durant allowed, quote, that a few simple men, that is the fishermen and other writers of the New Testament, should in one generation have invented so powerful and appealing a personality, so lofty an ethic, and so inspiring a vision of human brotherhood as Jesus did, would be a miracle far more incredible than any recorded in the Gospels. After two centuries of higher criticism, the outlines of the life, character, and teachings of Christ remain reasonably clear and constitute the most fascinating feature in the history of Western man. Now, I think it would be possible to go a great deal farther than Durant does. Indeed, I myself would, since I am a believing Christian and a believing Mormon. But the point is that if one's faith is to be responsible and informed, it should have access to the best, most informed thought on the subject of the historical Jesus, as well as a spiritual religious understanding based on faith. In 1987, a believing Mormon of average intelligence cannot go to a bookstore and find a single, not one, as far as I know, commentary on the Old or New Testaments written from a believing LDS perspective that also competently makes use of the tools of solid 20th century scholarship. You can for individual portions here and there, but not a New Testament or Old Testament commentary of which I am aware. If that seems like an impossible task, I would refer you to F.F. Bruce or to other evangelical scholars as worthwhile models. The general LDS refusal to use the tools of modern biblical scholarship in the 1830s was natural, because in America only a few Unitarian scholars had heard of such tools. The refusal by 1910, when Talmage wrote, was pardonable, for the church was small and vulnerable, and new methods of biblical criticism were novel and controversial enough to be fundamentally reshaping the very teams on which liberal and conservative Protestants played. But the fact that we have failed as a church to engage or even be very aware of modern scholarship today, as we approach the 21st century, a full generation after even Roman Catholics made their peace with modern biblical scholarship, lies somewhere between tragedy, comedy, and scandal. I don't mean to be too harsh in that assessment, but I am depressed on occasion when I think of the millions of involved in Mormon Sunday school classes, where if we take so much time to study the scriptures, but we take no time to understand the very nature and essence of the scriptures, then that seems to me a serious enough issue to be a little bit harsh about. That is urging change. So I end my assessment thanking Brother Thorpe and inviting you, whether or not you followed that orally, to take the issues presented in the paper seriously, and with a plea to any nascent biblical scholars among you who are also believing persons to come forth and help us. Thanks.
Thank you. It looks like we do have about 6 or 7 minutes that we could use by way of questions or answers or comments that you'd like to make. Anyone like to have anything that you'd like to ask or state? Yes.
How much confidence does Brother Thorpe place in textual criticism? And what should we replace it with? What should we do?
Oh, I think that as Mr. Barlow indicated, there's a lot of good, honest textual criticism that I think is very illuminating. Things like Raymond Brown's study of John, I think, stand out as a study that I think tends to, in essence, restore confidence in the text of John. F.F. Bruce, that he mentioned, for example, as a conservative figure, but one who, on the other hand, has come to grips with textual criticism. I don't think textual criticism is really necessarily a negative force. I think it's a force of attempting to come to an understanding of the text and also of the writings behind it. I think, too, that there's been a lot of interesting things. For example, it appears as if Q is now being thrown out in favor of an earlier rendition of Mark. And this would indicate that, obviously, we'll probably never have a complete understanding of the text. But I think, on the other hand, that if you read some of the recent books on this particular subject, and of course they're voluminous and a lot of them are very technical, that we've come a long way in the 20th century. I think textual criticism oftentimes suffers, too, from images of people like Rudolf Bultmann and the efforts to demythologize the New Testament, which most scholars have thrown out at the present time. So I think that textual criticism can help us to a deeper understanding of the text, although you have to remember that it is scholarship. You know, it's our, in essence, it's our way of understanding the text. Every generation has to come to grips with texts, and we'll never know in finality what the texts mean. But I think it's an honest effort, and I think there's a lot of good understanding that could be gleaned from this particular approach.
Well, we're about 1 minute away from ending anyway, so let's dismiss. Thank you very much.